Paperman meets such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press. Now you remember Mrs. Sadie Smuggery.
The Media Project is a half hour of commentary and analysis on news media operations, what's going on, and what some of the ethical questions are in American newsrooms. I'm Rex Smith from the Upstate American, formerly editor of the Times Union, and I'm here with my colleagues Judy Patrick and Barbara Lombardo. Judy Patrick, formerly editor of the Daily Gazette. Barbara Lombardo, formerly executive editor of the Saratogian and the Record of Troy. So what do you guys want to talk about? You guys.
You know, currently, I read with real interest this new Pew survey that shows that much of America is as confused about what makes a journalist as I am. What are the qualifications and who is a journalist and who's not? It's a real issue for our industry as we go forward.
Well, that's a good topic.
I like that too. And who can you believe? And what's the role of a journalist as a hometown booster?
Ah, well, that's what I really want to get into. Thanks, Barbara, because I'm really interested in that. I was reading an account of the former New York Times columnist Charles Blow, who was at a panel discussion on Martha's Vineyard. And he said local news performs a slightly different function from national and foreign news. He says it is about connecting people. Here's what Charles Blow said. The reporting on the opening of the grocery store or the closing of cleaners is really important to the community of people. Having the wedding announcements and the death notices and a real person writing about what the person's life was like. You thought, you know the guy at the end of the block. A real human impact. That makes people look at the people who are doing that reporting work as trusted members of the society, the community, and that trickles up. So his point is that the very community nature of local reporting lends credibility to the notion of journalism that is often lost in the national and foreign reporting and the political stuff, the big ticket stuff that we see all the time. And in the context of the Pew study that you were referring to, there was one interesting finding far down in it. 51% of respondents said that it was always or usually acceptable for journalists to advocate for the communities they cover. What do you think about that? We've all been community journalists, really. Is it okay to be a cheerleader?
It's a tricky line to be dancing along. Of course you want to represent your community. I always like to say that I thought the newspaper should be a catalyst for positive change in the community, that you're not just reporting, you are reporting in the news, but not just that, you're empowering people to take action to improve the community, and maybe you're showing leadership as the newspaper. But when are you advocating for something? Who are you representing as an advocate for your community? And there are divisions and differences of opinions, and you want to be careful that you're not covering certain news or avoiding critical news. It's a difficult line sometimes.
Yeah, advocating is a strong word. You don't want to shy away from covering the crime, for example, because that it gives your city a bad image. But on the editorial page, I think making the case for what is good or what benefits your readership is totally acceptable. But in the news coverage, I think you can't advocate one way or the other. I always remember, you know, what's good for General Motors is good for Detroit. Was that what it was? You know, and and we can't go there. I mean, I think that when projects come before a journalist to cover, you have to think about all the impacts of it and not just that this is going to be good for the economy, because maybe it's not good for the people whose houses are being torn down for the complex to be built. There are so many facets to the news we cover that advocating is not something that can be done on the hard news pages.
But localization is maybe a safer way to put it, that so many things that are happening on a national and state level, you really want to know, what does that mean to me in my community, on my school board, in my town, on my roads, with my funding? And that's where you can be an advocate by telling readers, what does this actually mean to us here, that we're all vested in this community?
Well, isn't this one of the key perils that we're now looking at with the loss of funding for public broadcasting? With the federal money now stripped away thanks to the Trump administration and its acolytes, there's now an effort by major foundations led by the Knight Foundation, which has always been a big funder of journalism, to raise $50 million this year to fund public broadcasters who have lost the money, focusing especially on those smaller stations that are most dependent, have been most dependent upon the federal money. Those who are really going to be losing the opportunity and likely have to close without that federal support. So these foundations are stepping up to say, this is really important. You know, they pointed out that, for example, even as Congress was debating cutting off the funds, these public stations in Alaska were reporting threats about rising waters from a tidal wave. So this kind of stuff is where you really need the local coverage. And it's a good thing, isn't it, that foundations are stepping up to provide this funding?
Yeah, it's a short-term solution, though, isn't it? They can only do this for so long. It's going to be, I think, a cumbersome process for them to figure out who needs the money right away, because there are so many of these small local stations. They're going to have to make the case that they are indeed local, and then they do provide local news coverage. We're hearing reports that they're already laying off reporters at some of these stations, and they haven't gone dark yet, but it's pretty darn close to it. We need a longer-term solution. That's not going to come out of Washington for at least 3 years.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, there are about 100 TV and radio stations that are receiving more than 30% of their revenue from the federal government, from the Corporation of Public Broadcasting, and many of those are in danger of being cut. But if you're losing five times that amount that they're raising has vanished from the public media system. Now, most of that $535 million went to public television, and local public TV stations tend not to have very aggressive news reports, you know. And when you're talking about news coverage in public broadcasting, you're talking about radio. And it is not the WAMCs, not Northeast Public Radios of the world that are imperiled, although the cut will certainly hurt here, but it's the little stations, those that really are off across the countryside, that are in grave danger.
Right, that they may not have that wealthy benefactor in the backyard that can step up and provide the money in the short term. Can you imagine trying to deal with the 30% cut in your budget? I mean, that's drastic, and especially radio stations have more than personnel. They have to pay high electricity bills, I imagine, and equipment costs. They're not cheap operations to run.
But now here's the problem. Even with funding coming through, the reality is that journalism is in trouble, was in trouble before the loss of funding for public broadcasting. Since 2002, which coincidentally is the year that I became the editor of the Times Union, it was, in fact, the best year in Times Union's history financially.
Oh, man.
It was downhill. every minute of my editorship was downhill. Anyway, since 2002, the number of local journalists has dropped 75%.
Oh, wow.
So what do you do? There just aren't as many people to do that kind of local coverage that you were talking about earlier.
You know, I still get calls from publishers looking for editors, and I still scour my, you know, old list trying to find somebody who might want to be an editor, one of the toughest jobs in the business, I think, and one of the most thankless. But there just aren't that many people out there anymore, and you don't realize it until you actually have a position to fill in and you can't find it. I mean, I've heard from editors around the state that they're still having trouble hiring people. And people are leaving and they're not coming back. Are they coming out of the journalism schools still?
Yes, but most of them, of course, don't want to jump into the kind of local coverage that we're talking about.
Right.
There's a sense that, well, I'm going to go off and write about what's going on in Washington. That's always been the case. People have always had aspirations beyond the local, but I was really taken by the fact Brian Lehrer, who's the morning host on WNYC in New York City, said this great thing. I was at a public event where he was speaking in the spring. He was exhorting young journalists. He said, fall in love with local. And I think that's a really great message for young journalists, to pay attention to what an impact you can have on your community. I mean, think about that. We made a choice to stay in local communities and do this kind of work for a reason. There is a great satisfaction that comes from it, even if not as much prestige, perhaps, as being a columnist for the Washington Post.
On a small scale, that would be, I think, a good example of that. The University at Albany is part of a local news initiative, and they are partnering with local media outlets. And last semester, for instance, my class partnered with the Spotlight, the group of weekly newspapers in the Capital District, and most of my students wrote one or two articles for the Spotlight, and they had the excitement of seeing their work published in a local publication, and they actually were in the community, so they covered an event, they covered a speech, they went to the schools to write about their Capital projects and or about their school play or about proposals for free lunch programs and how that was going. So it really ran the gamut of the types of stories, and they got a sense of making a difference in a local community.
The gap also in coverage is being picked up. There are now some 400 or so nonprofit digital sites that are directly covering communities. All over the country, there are these local digital sites that are nonprofits, and they need support as well. The difficulty is that people have a sense that they don't need to pay for information. We all are resistant to putting money in to support the content that we want to subscribe to see. But if there's no funding, there aren't any journalists, really. So this is a difficult problem. And so there are kinds of solutions, there are ideas that have come out. Steve Waldman, one of the thinkers of journalism, I guess you'd say, a guy who has been at the forefront of some of these conversations about the future of journalism, is saying, why don't we have some sort of a system to generate funds, such as a tiny fee on the technology that brings us information? There was a time back when the Carnegie Commission first came through with the idea of public television. They said, why don't you put a couple of cents on every TV set that you sell to fund public broadcasting? Well, that's a clever thing, but nowadays that wouldn't be what you need. You'd need some sort of an additional tax on big tech, I guess, that provides the digital network that oversees broadcasting. And I think that's unlikely to pass in the era of Trump. But if the idea is put out there, it could generate support over years and eventually begin to happen.
Yeah, it's an interesting concept. You know, I think I'm going to think of myself as a journalism thinker from now on.
Journalism thinker.
Introduce me as such from now on. But you know, then we get into the whole issue of what's a news site or what's not. Are we going to start giving a piece of that money to the influencers? Are we going to give it to people who generate TikToks that have news value? I mean, I hate to be the naysayer here, but it is a real issue, and it would help funnel money into those less affluent organizations that operate in rural areas or in poor neighborhoods that need support as well. It's easy enough to fund a news site in a wealthy community. It's a lot harder in some of these small towns and poor neighborhoods. And so anything that deals with that, I'm in favor of.
You bring up a point that was also mentioned in that Pew study about what is a journalist. And the people who responded to the poll and the anecdotal evidence that they provided from forums they had with people, they're as confused as we are.
Yeah.
And what makes a journalist and also what makes a news outlet? And they said, as far as should journalists go through formal training, 60% said yes, 20% said no, 20% were not sure. But when you say formal training, do we want to be certified? Who does the certification? I think that would be a terrible idea, because that means the government would be controlling who qualifies as a journalist, and that is fraught with tons of problems. But training, other people mentioned anecdotally that training on the job, if they're learning from people who've been above them or schools, mentors, that could make journalists more credible.
You know, it has a real implications for our business, too, because, I mean, we've encountered it in our tenure, like who gets accepted into the press briefing, you know, who's eligible to attend, who's eligible to sit in, you know, the special section in, when you're covering a trial, who gets into the press box at the Racing Association. I can remember these issues coming up because a press pass or press parking is a valuable commodity. Even in New York State, they have those NYP plates. You have to really prove that you work for a viable news organization, typically one with libel insurance, before you're eligible to get one of those NYP plates, which I do not have, by the way.
It used to give you reserve parking spaces. I think there are like three spaces in Albany right next to the State Education Department building. Those are about the only benefit to those plates here, right?
You know, I always said our real reporters wouldn't identify themselves
right
in such a way with an NYP plate.
Well, now you don't want your car keyed, so
right.
Tires slashed. But that Pew study talked about how the older adults were looking at only the traditional news media for the most part as real, credible news sources. But the younger you got, if you're 40 or 30 and younger, then you were more open to thinking of podcasters and people with websites as possibly credible journalists. That makes total sense, but how do you measure it?
Yeah, how do you decide whether if there is going to be any funding derived from some sort of a community source from a tax or something? How would you say, well, does Laura Loomer get it because she has a podcast? Does it really go to the community organizations that are supporting the small cities that have nobody anymore covering them?
Or does the New York Times gobble it all up?
Right.
Well, it would seem like some of the websites that provide news, there's a couple of really good ones out of Vermont, for instance, that there should be a way to demonstrate that they are reporting news. This creates problems for the many independent journalists who are out there who are no longer or never were part of a traditional media organization. But there's a way to prove your credibility.
You know, we could do that. We could do a thumbs up, thumbs down, and we could meet as a panel. And yeah. And
that's it.
Yeah. I just need some old editors.
That's it. If you have ideas, folks, if you have some thoughts on this or other topics, media@wamc.org. is how you can send us your thoughts, your solutions, please. Barbara Lombardo, Judy Patrick, and I'm Rex Smith. We're here on the Media Project giving you some thoughts about these difficult issues that confront the news media these days in an environment that has changed so dramatically since we were youngsters in the business. Here's something that is also worth talking about in the context of how different things are, and that is the powerful news organizations that have a limited commitment, let's say, to truth-telling. I'm talking here in the context of Newsmax, a right-wing cable channel that has agreed to pay $67 million to settle a libel suit from Dominion Voting Systems. Remember, Dominion Voting Systems was targeted by the MAGA faithful, claiming that the voting machine company had rigged the votes in the 2020 presidential election. All of that untrue, intentionally spread, it turns out, by Dominion Voting Systems. Remember that Fox News had to pay $787 million from Dominion Voting Systems and still faces a $2.7 billion claim from Smartmatic. So there's a lot still out there. But the question is, what do you do about these news organizations that have obviously no commitment to serious truth-telling and have enough money to just pay these multi-million-dollar settlements?
Yeah, not only what do you do, but how do you get the message across to their loyal listeners and readers who are not getting the true story? That is one of the many things making my blood boil about all of these issues. And you know, I went to Newsmax to see how did they cover this. You know, did they even mention it? And amazingly, they did mention it, but they called it a positive sign. It's moving forward. We did nothing wrong. Hmm. I would mention in the New York Times story, it says that they were not required as part of the settlement to admit any wrongdoing. They took a shot at the judge, who in the case had determined that their defamation charges were worth going to trial. And instead, they denigrated the judge. And the stock market reacted positively to Newsmax's report, according to the Newsmax story, that their shares on the stock exchange rose 15% by the end of the day. So they said this is a positive story. It took me about 10 minutes to do the math, but I figured out that they only had to pay, the settlement was about 4% of what the original request for money was. So that's pretty tiny in the scheme of things.
I'm sorry. How long did it take you to do that math?
But you know what? So they're not really sorry. They paid the $67 million, which seems like a lot of money to me, but they didn't concede any wrongdoing, which...
Yeah, it was worse. They said they did nothing wrong.
Yeah, and so their viewers, which is the viewers we really wanted to get the correct information to, walked away thinking, oh, well, I guess $67 million isn't so bad, and they didn't do anything wrong. They were probably just trying to, you know, make that nasty little lawsuit go away. But it's probably covered by insurance.
Yeah, it's similar to the way Fox, where it was only almost a $1 billion settlement, did the same thing of ignoring.
So what are we going to do, Rex?
What are we going to do? Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I do think we just need to keep stressing as much as we can the difference between straightforward, honest news reporting. This is why it's important to sustain those local news organizations that make a difference, like this one that we're speaking on. It's why you can't let those big national organizations with a lack of attention to ethical journalism get away with it. We have new details that have emerged about what Fox News hosts were doing during the 2020 election. Jeanine Pirro, the former Westchester DA, who is now the Trump-appointed top federal prosecutor in Washington, bragging to the head of the Republican National Committee how much she had done to help the party and Donald Trump, while meanwhile she's asking Trump to give a pardon to her husband, who spent 16 months, now ex-husband, spent 16 months in federal prison on fraud charges.
Yeah, it was tax evasion, and that was one of Trump's last acts in his last term of office. Instead of going to the inauguration of the next president, the next duly elected president, he's sneaking off and giving pardons to Pirro's ex-husband.
And it's so brazen, and we've come numb to that it's so brazen. You know, I'm almost thankful that she's so brazen, so we know very clear where people at that network were coming from, but we kind of knew that. I mean, they are in constant contact with Trump when he's campaigning and when he's running, you know, the country. So we know that to some extent. The problem is, do their viewers know that it's wrong?
Well, when you tie back to the Pew survey, you find that readers and listeners, they consider TV news hosts, TV news shows as news makers and as news deliverers.
Hmm.
And yeah. Not journalists?
Well, they consider them a kind of journalist, yes.
Right, which it should be said, the likes of Jeanine Pirro are not.
Correct.
Okay. We also need to just take a little local moment here today. We have talked before about John Sarcone III, the top federal prosecutor in the Northern District. I think it's 32 counties from the northern border. The office is based here in Albany, New York. John Sarcone is a Trump administration appointee because he wasn't appointed by the president as U.S. attorney. It hasn't gone through the Senate. Therefore, he was an acting U.S. attorney. After 90 days, that expired, and the federal judges from the district would have had to appoint him. They declined to do so. And yet the attorney general named him special assistant, basically put him in place anyway. In any case, as we have reported here, Sarcone barred the Times Union reporters from his press lists after the Times Union reported that he was using a false address in Albany to comply with residency requirements. Okay, we've got this clear. So the TU reports on this, and there was some question, I think, anyway, about an incident in which he was supposedly threatened by a guy outside a hotel in downtown Albany. Now, an ethics complaint has been filed against Sarcone. This is by some nonprofit advocacy organization saying that he violated some rules during his tenure. This, however, doesn't make matters any easier for the journalists. And this goes back to the issue we discussed once before. What do you do with politicians who basically retaliate against you for your reporting?
I think you do have to make these kinds of complaints, even if nothing really would happen as a result of this. Maybe they just get a slap on the wrist. Maybe nothing happens. But you don't want to just accept it and walk away and say nothing. When there's an ethics violation, you need to make a complaint. Get on record, make the complaint.
You know, there's so many instances of this happening all over the country now. In fact, probably it's happened for decades. And we as journalists tend to just take it and move on and try to find an alternate way in or an alternate way to get the information. But I was happy to see the complaint. But yeah, does it make it harder for the journalists? You know, as we've said before on this program, whatever press release they were sending was probably nothing of use to them anyway. And probably people are redirecting it. You know, we will find an alternate way in, just like when they delay our FOIL requests. But it does make it immeasurably more difficult.
Yeah, and the shutout was short-lived, but still.
Still. It's hard when you have someone that you're supposed to be covering whose information is relevant to your story. It's hard for you to keep going back to these people, keep trying to be fair, providing coverage that is honest and fair about these people who are targeting the journalism organization and trying very hard to stifle the truth.
That's why journalists need to be people of good character and of great patience.
And honestly, I mean, I know this is going to sound self-serving.
But go ahead anyway.
Well, but, you know, think of the people that you worked with over the years. Think of, you know, we all had decades in journalism. I mean, I really worked with people of high moral character, people who wouldn't intentionally distort a story ever.
Would they take money in a paper bag of potato chips?
This is great. A reporter down in New York City got a bag of potato chips with apparently some cash in it from one of Mayor Eric Adams' aides, you know? No explanation why in the world. Now, she, the aide, says, oh, it's just a cultural difference. This reporter didn't understand. I was just trying to be friends. Nobody ever slipped me money in an envelope or in a potato chip bag.
It was probably all greasy, too.
Right. I hope it never happened. I don't think I ever got maybe a cup of coffee. Right. I threw away the bag and didn't look inside.
Yeah, there you go. That's all we have time for today. This episode of The Media Project has run its course. Barbara Lombardo and Judy Patrick are here. I'm Rex Smith. We are grateful to our producer, Dave Gustina, and we thank you for joining us. Come back again next week for another episode of The Media Project.
To get insurance, she employed skullduggery. She up and cut her husband's only throat. She chopped him into fragments. She stuffed him in a trunk. She shipped it all back yonder to her uncle in Podunk. Now newspapermen meet such interesting people. It must have startled poor old Sadie's unk. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, city desk. Hold the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess.
The Media Project is a national production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio. This week's projectors include former Times Union editor and current Upstate American Substack columnist Rex Smith, Judy Patrick, vice president for editorial development for the New York Press Association and former editor of the Daily Gazette, and Barbara Lombardo, adjunct professor at the University at Albany and former editor of the Saratogian. You can listen to The Media Project anytime at WAMCpodcast.org or anywhere you get your podcasts. I'm your producer, David Gustina. Thanks for listening.
Living stage now, newspapermen are such interesting people. When they know they've got a people's fight to wage. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, newspaper guild, got a free new world to build. Meet the people, that's a thrill, all together fits the bill. Oh, newspapermen are such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the guild. Now, publishers are such interesting people. Their policy is an acrobatic thing. They claim to represent the common people. It's funny, Wall Street never has complained. Ah, but publishers have worries, for publishers must go to working folks for readers and to big shots for their dough. Now publishers are such interesting people. It could be prostitution, I don't know. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, circulation, ting-a-ling-a-ling, advertising, get those readers, get that payoff. What a headache, what a mess. Oh, publishers are such interesting people. Let's give free cheers for freedom of the press.